Okay. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be invited here again. I think I was here like in 2002 or 2003, and I'm very glad to be here again. I'm going to talk mostly about, it's not a very technical talk. I wanted to talk about the difference between finance and the hard sciences and the social sciences of finance and physics. And so that's kind of my topic. And the short sort of version of my talk, which I might as well say, is really that I want to make a big distinction between the difference between theories and models and between what's possible in the natural sciences and what's much less possible in, let me say, finance, to be specific. And I want to say that theories are kind of the real thing and models are approximations, but I'm going to be more precise. So let me go into it. So this is sort of an outline of my talk. I want to start by talking about metaphors and which is the, oh, okay. And then I want to talk about models and really argue that models are really just extended kind of metaphors where you compare something to something else, and talk a little about why is a model a model and what makes a model a model. And then I want to talk in contrast about theories, and most theories tend to be mathematical, but I want to kind of give an example of showing something that's a theory that isn't mathematical, although it's inspired by mathematics, which is sort of a theory of emotions of Spinoza that I think has all the qualities of a theory. I'm going to distinguish between a true theory and a false theory, but theories in intent, not necessarily in results. And then I want to talk a little more about finance, contrast and models in finance, the scientific foundations, what I think finance, what laws there are in finance, and I'm probably going to skip that because I'm going to talk a little about the right way to use models, what I think is the right way to use models. So I want to start by talking about metaphors, and I found this nice metaphor actually. It comes from Schopenhauer, and it says sleep is the interest. That's a financial metaphor. Sleep is the interest that we have to pay on the capital, which is called in at death. And the higher the rate of interest and the more regularly it is paid, the further the date of redemption is postponed. It's very pretty and as insightful about sleep as anything I've seen. Nobody really knows why you sleep. But if you think about it, what he's doing is it's sort of a kind of analytic continuation in that what he's really doing is he's focusing on the periodic nature of sleep. Sleep is something you do every night, and coupon payments are something you pay every day. And because they both pay periodically, he's then saying, okay, I sort of understand something about finance, and the reason why you pay periodic payments, well, I'm belaboring this, but the reason why you pay periodic payments is finance is because you once borrowed money from somebody and you have to pay it back, and therefore the reason why you make periodic losses of consciousness to sleep is because you once borrowed your consciousness from somewhere and you're going to have to pay it back one day. I kind of like it. But it is a metaphor. I said periodicity of sleep and coupons is a common element of the metaphor, and it really is a metaphor. It's saying that it's an insight that states that something you want to understand, like sleep, is actually a lot like something you think you already understand, ostensibly, which is bonds and interest and borrowing and lending. And I like to think of it as a kind of analytic continuation based on some similarity, and usually it's constricting. In this case, sleep is like finance. Sleep is like a bond, but it isn't a bond. In some case, and so it ends up being clever, but being constricting in some way. But metaphors can also, an analytic continuation can also extend your understanding. If you think about real analytic continuation, and you take, for example, the factorial function, which just reminds me of the thing about the factorial function is you can define f of n equals n f of n minus 1 with a recursion relation, but it only holds for discrete integer positive n. And then I suppose Euler invented the gamma function by trying to analytically continue the function to fractional and complex numbers, but the key property that it has to reproduce is this one quality, which is n equals or z equals z, sorry, f of z equals z, f of z minus 1. You end up with a gamma function, in which case you've actually got something much richer, not much more constricting. So somehow in mathematics, this whole business of metaphors or analytic continuation actually takes you somewhere richer. It's sort of very rare that that's what it actually does when you use it in the modeling world in general, which I'm going to come to. And the last remark I was going to make really just about metaphors is that if you think a lot about, a lot of your language is actually really a layer, much of the things that you say in real life are really a sort of layer of metaphors. People sometimes claim that the people who invented, I suppose, any language but English, in the early vocabulary were really wonderful poets because of the way all the words you use end up being metaphors. And so, for example, you say I feel high or I feel low, or I feel elated or I feel depressed. And these aren't really concrete statements, they're metaphors based on the fact that high is kind of good and low is kind of bad. And the reason why high is good and low is bad ultimately is because you sort of wetware in the end, you're not software, but you've got a real physical existence in a gravitational field, and it's hard to pull yourself up, and down is bad and up is good. And similarly, if you say things look light or things look dark to me, it's also based on the fact that ultimately you have five senses which really respond to your physical state. So a lot of your mental statements are metaphors based on statements about your physical existence. I used to sometimes wonder, but I've never had a good answer, as if people eventually grow up in outer space and they have no gravity and no fluctuations in light and dark, what words are they going to use for feeling happy or feeling sad? I'm not really sure, but I think maybe it's full and empty. So let me flip this forward. So now I want to talk about models, and I really think the reason I talk about metaphors is I really think that models are to some extent in finance and in physics a lot like elaborations of metaphorical insights. So I try to look at the word model and see all the different cases in which people use the word model to see some sense of what it means. When I was a kid, I used to build, the first thing that comes to mind is model airplanes or model trains when I used to build airplanes out of balsa wood and put the frames together. I think most of you are too young over here to remember the world when you used to do that. But you used to get these kits that you pieced together and glued. And balsa wood was very flexible and very strong for very lightweight. And actually I gave a talk a couple of days ago, and somebody told me that the Mosquito, the last plane built in World War II, built out of balsa wood, the Mosquito fighter built in World War II was actually made out of balsa wood with a canvas frame. I didn't think people actually built real planes out of that. Anyway, the reason why it's a model, what makes it a model, it seems to me what makes it a model is that it's got only a limited but nevertheless a significant resemblance to properties that you're interested in. So if you're a 10-year-old building model airplanes, you care about the fact that it looks like an airplane and that it has a fuselage like an airplane and struts that you cut together and glue and varnish. But it isn't the airplane. If you're an aeronautical engineer, you care much more, less about the inside, say if you put in a wind tunnel, but more about the surface to see, you know, what the right air resistance and friction and lift is. If you're a 2-year-old, you just care that you can look like an airplane made out of plastic and you can push it through the air and make airplane noises. What's key is what properties are important to you and what of those properties are embodied in the model. But it's still a model in that it's not the real thing. If you look at fashion models, it's kind of similar. Only the surface is important for the most part, although fashion models have auras. But you don't really care about the person that much. You care about the way clothes look on it. It, he, she. So again, a limited resemblance to the real thing. Whether models are, I'm not a big expert on any of this, but weather models, it seems to me you deal with things, or climate models, you deal with things like pressure and temperature, which sound like they're very concrete, but in fact they are abstractions. It's just that they've been around for 300 years and they're macroscopic and everybody knows pretty precisely what they mean by pressure and temperature and how to measure it, and pretty much know Boyle's law, Charles' law, heat conduction, how these things behave. And so there's not much doubt with weather models about the variables that you're using or about the equations for the most part that they obey, except maybe on the tail ends of distributions. The limitations, it seems to me, are really the emissions, in that there's a lot of chemistry and biochemistry going on in the Earth, and nobody really knows where to stop and how to take account of what the effect of rises in temperature on algae growth and stuff like that are. And so what's really missing is not so much... it's not so much that the whole thing is so abstract, but that you're missing, there are a lot of effects going on and you just simply can't take care, you never know whether you've taken account of all of them. When you come to economic models, it seems to me it's a lot worse. It's still only a partial resemblance to the real thing, but it seems to me economic models are much more abstract, because you start talking about things like supply and demand, and unlike pressure and temperature, which you can define pretty precisely, when you talk about supply or demand or liquidity, which really, even in the nature of the word, is clearly a metaphorical reference to liquids flowing and viscosity and friction, they really are abstractions that aren't even well defined. You know, if you talk about liquidity, people, as an example, people have all kinds of proxies for liquidity, like bid-ask spread or fraction of daily volume traded, and all of these things are measures of liquidity or proxies for liquidity, but nobody has a very comprehensive definition of liquidity that says this is liquidity. They're all sort of projections of what you imagine by liquidity onto some smaller space that you can then use to write an equation on. And supply and demand are even harder to measure. So it seems to me there the limits are not just the emissions and the equations, but even the concepts are pretty vague and an extension. In fact, somebody I read an excerpt from a paper by Hayek where he said he was kind of against a lot of quantitative financial modeling, and he said that people go the wrong way. In physics, the observables are the macroscopic variables like pressure and temperature. And you then go through statistical mechanics, from thermodynamics to statistical mechanics, and deduce the existence of abstractions like atoms and molecules and electrons, and do statistics of them, and those are the abstractions. But the microscopic things are the abstractions, and the macroscopic things are the so-called real things, although of course they're also abstractions at some level. But in economics, it's the other way around. He argued that it's the microscopic things that are real, namely you and me and how you feel every day. And things like markets and supply and demand are really the abstractions, and so people are sort of going in, I'm not sure whether I agree, but his argument is that people are going in the wrong direction. They're trying to start, as in physics, with the macroscopic things, but actually the macroscopic things are the non-observables in the social sciences, and it's the microscopic things that are observable. So be it. And the last example, I have two more examples, actually, of models. One is, there's something called the liquid drop model of the nucleus inside an atom. The atom is 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, and the core of an atom in the nucleus is about 10 to the minus 12 centimeters. And if you take uranium, it's got 238 protons and neutrons, and it's very dense. And one of the Nobel Prizes given to Bohr's son, Agarbohr, and Modelson about 40 or 50 years ago was for a liquid drop model of the nucleus, in which they modeled the nucleus as being like a continuous viscous liquid drop that could vibrate and rotate and had normal modes of oscillation and rotation. And they calibrated that to the things that you see, and then were able to predict excitations by calibrating the density and the I don't really remember, but probably the elasticity to things you can already observe. And then predicted higher order excitations correctly, and they got the Nobel Prize for that. But it really is a model in the sense that the nucleus isn't a liquid drop. Maybe a drop of water isn't really a liquid drop if you look tight enough, but nevertheless, the nucleus isn't a liquid drop. It's just a statement that in some range of experience, it's a reasonable way to look at it, but it's not reality. Opposed to that is the standard model in high-energy particle physics, which also Plasha Weinberg-Salam got a Nobel Prize for in the early 80s, and that's really, I think, although people call it the standard model, I want to argue shortly that it's really a theory, to segue into that, because it takes weak interactions and electromagnetic interactions, two previously more or less disconnected theories, and unifies them via some symmetry group, which, when you take it seriously, predicts the existence. In order to, you sort of see weak interactions and you see electromagnetic interactions, and you say they have to be connected via some symmetry group, and when you complete the group, you discover that they have to be other interactions and other particles that mediate those interactions which had never been observed, and then people go and look for them and find them. And I would argue that's maybe it's not the absolute truth, but it's I'm going to get onto this more a little bit, but it's a theory, not a model, in that it's not saying the world behaves like this. It's saying the world, say this is the way the world is made. So I've said some of this, but what I really want to say, a model isn't the thing itself. There's always a gap in all the examples I gave, except maybe for the standard model, between the model and the system you're using to describe it. Sorry, between the model you're trying to describe, you're using, and the system you're actually trying to describe. And so I don't know. I'll go through this quickly, but in some sense, it's a caricature. Like I sometimes think a lot of a lot of financial engineering and quantitative finance programs are. I'm at Columbia in the engineering school, and everybody tends to concentrate more on Monte Carlo. Although it's a multidisciplinary field, they tend to do more simulation. If you go to the math department, they tend to do more PDEs. If you go to a business school, they do something different. But everybody's trying to teach the same field, but they accentuate that part of the face that they're best at, or that they're most competent to teach. It focuses on parts, a model. It's a bit of a caricature. It's kind of a metaphor with limited applicability. I was going to say it's a bit of a fetish, but I don't have the time to go into that. But I think it's true. Again, you're taking, if you're a fetishist. But I've got a good imagination. Then you focus on some part of somebody or some part of their clothing rather than on the whole thing. And it's exciting, but it's not true. Okay. Another good thing about models, good or bad, quality of models, is what people use models for a lot is to transform, incorporate lower level knowledge into you in a visceral sort of way so you can move up one level. So if you learn to speak the language of models, then a lot of consciously learned stuff eventually becomes unconscious and you can use it and move up one level higher. You have to digest all the so to go back to my language example, which is a bit trivial, you can just say you're depressed and everybody understands what you mean, whereas once upon a time you had to explain that depressed means I feel as though I'm in a low place. But once you eventually get to incorporate the higher level, you can start to say I feel groovy eventually, and somebody will understand that too. So the good part about models is once you absorb somebody else's model and you use it, it really becomes a labor-saving device, and it allows you to avoid to move up a level and avoid thinking or doing a lot of hard work for yourself because somebody's done it and incorporated in a formalism. And a lot of the hard work, I think, in research is somehow, when you build a model, is sort of first getting the intuition and then, I'm going to come to this, and then trying to standardize it in a way that other people can use it. And one good example is Feynman diagrams, which are, I'm going to argue later, they're more like a theory, but in a sense, they're a mnemonic for doing very complicated theoretical things that become, once you learn them, they become an easy way to do them. And I'm not sure I have the time to go into it, but the two people who invented quantum field theory was Schwinger and Feynman and Tominaga in Japan during the war. And Feynman did it very intuitively in a diagrammatic sort of way, and his method ultimately became pretty much the standard method that everybody learns. Schwinger did it very labor-intensively with great skill and mathematical power. And I think he was sort of a bit resentful from what I've read about the fact that everybody embraced Feynman's method. And he one day said something that Feynman diagrams were like silicon chips in that they brought computation to the masses. I think he kind of despised it, like people who didn't like you getting calculators or Mathematica when you should still be doing things the hard way. But it does let you move up a level. But at a cost, maybe not with Feynman diagrams, I'm going to come back, but at a cost, in that most models, the liquid drop model, they sort of reduce dimensionality in the sense they project something really complicated onto a much simpler, lower dimensional space and then allow you to interpolate and extrapolate in that space. I'm going to give examples. And it becomes very useful and very effective, but you lose something about reality when you do that. I said this, they allow you to extrapolate or interpolate in a low dimensional space. And the last remark I was going to make before I go into theories is that you start to incorporate all this knowledge until it becomes unconscious, and at some point, if things break down, as they did with sort of Newtonian physics and absolute space and time, and there comes a time when that whole instinctive visceral understanding of absolute space and time, say that you inherit from Newton and Galileo, doesn't work, but nobody realizes why it doesn't work, and there comes a time when somebody has to re-examine their basic assumptions, say like Einstein, and realize that there's a principle of special relativity, or even general relativity, rather than Galilean relativity. So you can go a certain way on riding on models or even theories, but at some point progress comes when you start looking at the things you have incorporated and not thought about anymore. I can't make this pop up, but it looks kind of impressive the way it is. I was going to talk about theories, and what I wanted to say is that what I've been trying to say until now is that models are really analogies, and they say something that you want to understand is a lot like something you already understand. And so they sort of analogies, and they relative in the sense they compare something over here to something over there. And they never tell you absolutely what something is like. They only tell you, you understand that, then you can understand this. You understand finance, you can understand sleep. Theories, I think, are really different. They're kind of the real thing, in the sense they absolute, and they try to describe the way the world is, or the way something is, rather than what it's like. This is a little bit metaphorical myself, but I think a theory is sort of the ultimate non-metaphor. And I sort of, when I was a kid, I used to go to Hebrew school, and I learned the story of the burning bush. I don't know if everybody's familiar with it here, but about Moses being in the desert and God telling him to go and tell Pharaoh to let his people go, and he doesn't want to do it, so he runs away into the desert and he comes across a burning bush which keeps burning and doesn't extinguish, and presumably God is inside there and tells him to go and do his duty, and he doesn't really want to do it, and he says, I don't want to do it, and when God twists his arm, he says, who shall I say sent me? And God says to him, that says, Ehiyah Sherer here. He says, I am that which I am, or I am that which I will be. And I kind of like it in the sense he's saying, I'm not like anything else. I am what I am, or in a worse way, it is what it is. And you can't compare it to anything else. And I think that's kind of the characteristic in some sense, at least to me, of a real theory as opposed to a model. Theories tell you what something is. Models tell you what something is more or less like. What I wrote over here is the Dirac equation for the electron, which is sort of related to Feynman. Feynman's original theory of quantum electrodynamics is actually the equation that describes, that's the Dirac equation for an electron, and this is Maxwell's equation for electric and magnetic fields, and Feynman's quantum theory of electrodynamics describes how to solve that perturbatively. And the Dirac equation is also actually interesting. It's a little bit related to what I was saying about sleep, and that what Dirac did when he first wrote it down, he was a big believer in mathematical beauty, and he wrote down this equation. They had quantum mechanics already. They had the Schrodinger equation, and it satisfied quantum mechanics, which is the wave function and the uncertainty principle, but it didn't satisfy relativity, special relativity, which says that every frame, all moving frames are equally good for describing the laws of nature. And when you use the Schrodinger equation, it really only works in an absolute frame. And Dirac wanted to unify both of them, and he wrote down this equation, which is actually an equation for a four-dimensional vector, a vector with four components, for this wave function psi, and it was relativistically invariant and was a quantum mechanical equation. And when he solved it, this psi ended up having four solutions for a free particle. And two of them really described the electron very accurately, much better than the Schrodinger equation did, in that it described, when you solved it for a hydrogen atom, it gave you the right magnetic moment of an electron, and it gave you the right spin. People already knew that electron actually was quantized and had spin up or spin down, but they knew that from the energy levels of electrons and looking at the energy levels of hydrogen atoms and looking at the radiation that they emitted. And they knew there were two components, that every electron could be in two states, but they just glued that onto their previous theory. And when Dirac solved this equation, there were four solutions, and the first two really described an electron with two independent degrees of internal freedom, spin up or spin down. And so everybody was incredibly impressed, but there were two other solutions which were kind of the same, except they had negative energy, and nobody really knew what to make of negative energy solutions, since everything you see in life sort of by convention has positive energy. And so people didn't really, for 3 or 4 years after 1928, when this came out, didn't really like the theory, although there were some parts that were phenomenally good. And part of the trouble was also that if you have the two positive energy electrons, all electrons in a hydrogen atom can radiate energy and emit a photon and drop down to a lower energy level. And if you allow negative energy electrons, then electrons with negative energy, with minus energy, whatever that means, and then an electron with positive energy can actually emit a photon and drop down to a negative energy and emit another photon and drop down to a negative energy and finally just keep going forever. So everything's unstable. And so there's clearly something wrong. And what Dirac was eventually led to do was to invoke the sort of metaphorical Dirac C SEA, which said that actually the world you live in, the vacuum, even when there's nothing there, is filled with negative energy electrons all the way from energy minus infinity up to zero. And so the reason why all the positive energy electrons that you see can't actually radiate away to forever is because the sea is full, like full to the brim. And so he was led to postulate this direct sea, but then realized that in that case, this is a little bit related to that thing I was saying about sleep. He then realized that in that case, if you know what the photoelectric effect is, when you shine light into matter, you can eject an electron. He realized that if you just have nothing in space at all, but they're all negative energy electrons over there, if you shine powerful enough, energetic enough light into the vacuum, into empty space, there's a negative energy electron in there which is invisible, and you can give it energy and kick it up and give it positive energy and you should see it. And so you can do sort of the photoelectric effect on empty space. And it sounded funny, but then what he and other people realized was, the reason you're born into this vacuum which is full of negative energy electrons, and it's like air having no smell, you know, when you're born, presumably. I don't know whether air smells or not, but since it's the background, you say, I'm not aware of it. And in the same way, all these negative energy electrons are just the world you live in. You don't really call that charge at all. Then you realize that if you kicked out one negative energy electron, you would leave a hole behind in the sea of negative energy electrons, and that hole would behave like the absence of an electron. And the absence of an electron is a hole that can move around inside all of these other negative energy electrons, and the absence of a negatively charged electron would behave like a positively charged electron. Just if you can imagine a hole in one of these puzzles that you slide around, you know, where you have 16 squares and you have to get the numbers in the right order, and you're really moving the blocks, but it looks like the hole is moving. So he was led to postulate the existence of this absence of a negative electron, which actually behaves like a positive electron and would be a particle identity to the electron, but an antiparticle called the positron. And 4 years later, quite unaware of this, Anderson at Caltech discovered this particle. This is really one of the first great triumphs of this metaphorical theory, which really became a theory that predicted the existence of a new particle. Maxwell's equations, I mentioned, that's a direct equation. And what I want to say is, I think this is really a theory. When you have a model, if somebody says to you, the nucleus is like a liquid drop, you can say why, and they have to have an answer. But if somebody says to you, light obeys Maxwell's equations, or the electron obeys the Dirac equation, you can't say why. That's just the way it is. And so I think that's kind of the characteristic of a theory. You have to, there's a limit to the chain of whys you can ask. At some point you just hit rock bottom. And I think that's why the Dirac equation is a theory, and Maxwell's equations. And the other thing is, I think people recognize this, whereas people say the nucleus is like a liquid drop, or the brain is like a computer, or the computer is like a brain, or whichever way you want to look at it. Nobody says light is like Maxwell's equations. When people talk about light, they say light satisfies Maxwell's equations, because they somehow recognize deep inside them that even if it's not 100% right, there's a very close identity between the object and its representation. Okay, so I said this before, a theory provides non-metaphorical insight and deals in absolutes and often uses math for that reason. And I was going to say theories, in that sense, theories are kind of deep and inexplicable. Maybe that's what makes them deep. And models, nothing wrong with it, but models are shallower in the sense you have to justify them and explain in what sense something is like something else. You don't have to do that when you describe the way you think something is. I said that. Okay. I wanted to give an example of, I have till 7, is that right? Okay. I want to give an example just to say you can have theories which don't have to invoke mathematics. And there's this book by Spinoza called The Ethics, in which he's actually trying to figure out the right way that people should live. But along the way, he actually avowedly, in the beginning, he's very impressed with Euclid. This was in the mid-1600s. And with the elements of geometry, and he wants to treat human beings the way Euclid treats geometrical objects. And so he wants to start with axioms and principles and develop a whole theory of the way people behave. And he does this for emotions. and you end up seeing it's actually emotions are like derivatives in his theory. And he says it really is a theory, it's not a metaphor, he just wants to use the axiomatic and propositional style of mathematics. And so in the same way as Euclid starts with lines and points, and a point is something that has no extent, and I forget what a line is, but you wouldn't actually understand what it was if you didn't have some gut knowledge of what a point and a line was anyway, from physical experience. In the same way, he starts out, these primitives are not points and lines, but are desire, pleasure, and pain. And he actually, I'm not going to go into it, he defines what they are. But again, just like you know what a point and a line is without being told, and it wouldn't make sense, the definition wouldn't make any sense if you hadn't actually seen it with your eyes and been taught. In the same way, everybody more or less knows what desire, pleasure, and pain are. And then he defines good. I'm just going through this because I want to give an example of something that I think, true or not, is a theory in the sense it doesn't refer to anything else, that only refers to itself. So he says good is everything that brings pleasure and evil is everything that brings pain. So it's not good in the sense of morally good, it's simply good because it makes you feel good, and evil is bad because it makes you feel bad. And love, then everything else is actually a derivative. So love is pleasure associated with it's a derivative of the three underliers. Love is pleasure associated with an external object, and hate is pain associated with an external object. So these are like options, the underliers of stocks. And then envy is like a convertible bond. It's pain at somebody else's pleasure. And he doesn't have Schadenfreude, which is pleasure at somebody's pain. But he's very clever. He actually says that there are all sorts of emotions which don't yet have names, but which he can define. And finally, he has hope, which is expectation of future pleasure tinged with doubt. And joy is actually, I've got a whole table of them. Joy is what happens when the expectation of future pleasure gets fulfilled, and disappointment is when it doesn't. And fear is expectation of future pain, and cruelty is like a triple derivative. It's the desire to, it's what you call somebody's desire to inflict pain on someone that you love. I think it's very clever, actually. And he's got three more primitives, which are also underliers, but not derivatives. And the vacillation, which is the state of oscillating between two different emotions in an uncontrolled sort of way. And wonder, which is the feeling you have when you're confronted by something that has no relation to anything else at all. And contempt is the feeling you have when you're confronted by something whose main effect is to remind you of what it doesn't have. Hence contempt. This is an example I made. I haven't finished it yet, but I tried tracing from his definitions all the dependencies, and you can see I won't go through it. But he's actually got every emotion, just about every emotion you can think of. I don't have them all here, related to pain and desire and pleasure, and the ones that are related to three have three arrows in them. I don't have a lot of time, but what I was going to say about theories is that I think it sort of takes intuition to discover theories in some way. You don't just get them by straightforward deduction. If you look at Kepler's laws, which eventually led to Newton's theories, one of Kepler's laws is that the line from the planet to the sun sweeps out equal areas in equal times. And if you think about it, if you look at data and you look at trajectories of planets, it's not immediately obvious. It's actually coming to the law of angular momentum later on. It's not immediately obvious that the right way to look at this is to look at the area that the planet sweeps out. It takes some sort of insight to even think of looking things in that way, or some sort of spark of inspiration. And I was going to give some examples. I was going to say intuition may sound casual, but it actually takes intimate knowledge acquired by careful observation, which is what Kepler did, and painstaking effort. And I have two quotes that I like, and then I'm going to go on. But Keynes, who's in the news again these days, and Newton's tercentenary, which should have been in 1942, but it was World War II, they only celebrated in 1946 at Cambridge in England, and Keynes looked through all of Newton's papers, which were in a box in Cambridge, England, and he was a bit of an alchemist, Newton, and a sort of a mystic in his own way. And Keynes was dead already, but he had written a speech, and his brother delivered it, and he said about Newton, "I believe that the clue to his mind is to be found in his unusual powers of continuous concentrated introspection. His peculiar gift was the power of holding continuously in his mind a purely mental problem until he had seen straight through it." And I wanted to read the end of that somewhere. He said, I believe that Newton could hold a problem in his mind for hours and days and weeks until it surrendered to him its secret. Then, being a supreme mathematical technician, he could dress it up how you will for the purposes of exposition. But it was his intuition which was preeminently extraordinary. So happy in his conjecture, said De Morgan, as to seem to know more than he could possibly have any means of proving. And he goes on to say, it looks like the proofs he makes up for his results are not the way he derived his results. Which is kind of interesting because Maxwell said almost the same thing about Ampere. Ampere derived the equivalent of Coulomb's law for two current elements. And he said he derived them from experiment. But if you think about experimenting, you can't experiment on current elements. Currents are always part of some big circuit, yet Ampere wrote down a law for DI1 and DI2, two current elements, and the force between them, which led to Maxwell's equations. And Maxwell said later, 20 years later, we can scarcely believe that Ampere really discovered the law of action by means of the experiments which he describes. We led to suspect what indeed he tells us himself, that he discovered the law by some process which he has not shown us, and that when he had afterwards built up a perfect demonstration, he removed all traces of the scaffolding by which he had built it. Somebody once said this, I saw Delman said something about some theory too, and he described it to some, I forget now, but some sort of kind of cooking in which you sort of cook something between two slices of ham, and then you remove the ham, and the taste is there, but the ham is gone. I was going to try to talk a little bit about models in finance. I've got like 9 minutes. So I was trying to say, I think first approximation, there are no theories in finance. Everything's a model. If you say the Black-Scholes equation, what you're saying in some sense is stock prices behave as though they diffuse like smoke, but it's always an as though or as like. It's not. This isn't the way they are. This is the way I would like to think about them in some approximation. And I think the other point I want to make is, at least in my experience in working with most models in finance, is that in physics, the point of models or theories is somehow divination, to tell you what's going to happen in the future. If you shoot a rocket to the moon, you can do it because of Newton's laws. And you understand exactly what the trajectory is going to be in the future. I think people are often misguided about the way financial models, as opposed to economic models, are used. The point isn't usually divination or for telling the future, which really doesn't work very well. And I wanted to give a quick example of a sort of easily understandable financial model that I think captures what most more sophisticated financial models are like. So imagine you live in New York and you want to buy a penthouse on Park Avenue, which is a fancy area, and you want to buy a 10-room penthouse. And it's very illiquid, and there aren't a lot of them, and you don't know what you should pay for it because it hasn't traded in a while. But there is a liquid market in studio apartments in Battery Park City near Wall Street, where people are moving in and out all the time. So how would you go about, if you're a real estate agent, I'm making this up, but I think it's reliable, how would you go about getting an estimate for the price of the Park Avenue apartment? And my answer is, you would sort of replicate it. You would say, okay, one 10-bedroom Park Avenue apartment is roughly like, in square footage, like 8.5 Battery Park City studios. And so assuming price per square foot is constant, then I can scale up to the price of a big apartment from the smaller one in a different area, if that's the last trade I could see. And then you say, okay, well, that's not bad, but actually, it's only a first order approximation. Park Avenue is a better environment, and there are more doormen, and the school district is better or worse, and you've got a view of the park, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to add higher order corrections, which modify my first order, my zeroth order model. And so what you're trying to do is not predict the future price of the Park Avenue apartment. What you're trying to do is move from a liquid market, which is studio apartments, to an illiquid market, which is something that hasn't traded a lot, and you're trying to do it via some model. And what's the model? The model is price per square foot is constant across apartments. And it's not even price per square foot, it's actually implied price per square foot, because there are a lot of things in the apartment, what kind of appliances you have and how many windows you have, which have nothing to do with the square footage, but you're forcing all of that to be quoted as price per square foot. And so it's obviously not right, but it's not completely wrong either. But it's an implied price per square foot, assuming that you can divide the apartment price, assuming that all that matters is the square footage, but all that matters isn't the square footage, but it's a big part of it. And I think a lot of the models in Black-Scholes and in other financial models work in a similar way. What they do is they take something you can think about linearly and turn it into a dollar value. So in Black-Scholes, you take volatility, which you can sort of think about when you get sophisticated enough, and turn it into a dollar value for an option. In this model, you take price per square foot, which you have some feel for, and translate it into value for apartments. And if you want to predict the future price of the apartment, the model says to you, what do you think the future price per square foot is going to be? In the same way, if you want to say what the price of an option is, Black-Scholes says to you, you tell me what I think volatility is going to be in the future. It doesn't forecast volatility. That's another story. Same way with yield to bond price, volatility to option price. And so what I really want to say is, the last two things I want to say are actually what models are really useful for in finance is to do this decrease in dimensionality, which is to take something very complicated, like say you take bonds which have different coupons and different maturities and different issuers, and you quote all of them by yield to maturity, and it puts everything on a one-dimensional scale that gives you some way of ranking things by value, and then you make corrections because your model wasn't quite right. So what models are really used a lot for is to produce a valuation in a complicated world, same way ranking apartments by price per square foot. I mentioned this, models allow you to interpolate from liquid apartments to illiquid ones, from liquid treasury bonds to mortgages by using internal rate of return or yield to maturity, or if you get more sophisticated, some option model. But and Black-Scholes is an interpolation model too. It says, you tell me the price of a stock and you tell me the price of a bond, and I'll tell you the price of an option, which is a sort of hybrid somewhere between a stock and a bond. I'm going to skip this because I only have a few minutes left. I was going to say, there's a joke by Andy Lowe at MIT, which often gets quoted, where he says that physics has 99 laws. Physics has three laws. I almost spoiled it. I did spoil it. Physics has three laws that explain 99% of the phenomena, and finance has 99 laws that explain 3% of the phenomena. And it's kind of a good line, but I actually don't think it's true. I think really there's only one law that's approximately true in finance, and that's reliable, and that's the law of one price, or the law of replication. That's, if you want to know the value of a financial security, the way to get its value is to use the known price of another security or portfolio of securities that are as similar to the one you're interested in as possible. Which, like the, so when I've got the 10-room apartment, what's the closest similarity is 8.5 one-room apartments. That's just another statement of the law of one price, which says any two securities with identical future payoffs, no matter how the future turns out, should have identical current prices. And so if you want to build a model, you have to satisfy, you want to prove similar, a model lets you calculate the value of something, estimate the value of something illiquid from liquid things. And the way to do it is, first of all, the science part is you have to specify, no matter how the future turns out. They have to have identical future payoffs no matter how the future turns out. So the science part, the stochastic calculus part, is saying, what do you mean by all future scenarios? Do you mean Brownian motion? Do you mean geometric Brownian motion? Do you mean geometric Brownian motion with jumps? Whatever it is. You try to write down a one-line equation for the way the universe will behave in the future. And to cut a long story short, you're going to get it wrong. And then once you've written that down, you try to prove that this is the engineering part, you try to say, this is the thing I'm interested in, those are the things whose prices I know, how do I construct a replicating portfolio under all those scenarios of the things I have to play with and make them equivalent or similar to the thing whose value I want to know. And that's the engineering part. And I don't have time, but where everything goes wrong is not so much in the summary of payoffs, but in nobody's smart enough to specify. You can write down a one-line equation for the Dirac equation that really describes the way electrons behave. Nobody's succeeded, nor will they, in writing down a one-line equation for the stochastic evolution of all the markets you can think of, or any one market you can think of. That's just the way it is. It's not a catastrophe, but it's unrealistic to think otherwise. So I'm going to finish off and really say, I think in view of what I said, the right way to build valuation models, because of all the problems I said and because there's no real theory, is really to assume the bare minimum, which means, for those of you who know some finance, to start with static replication, which involves as little trading and static portfolio that will match the payoffs of the thing you're interested in at expiration without doing any additional trading. Simplest way to do it and most reliable, and the best way to price something or to hedge something. If you can't do that, you do dynamic replication, which is like Black-Scholes and which is a great discovery, but makes many more assumptions because it then says you have to trade along the way. If you want to trade along the way, you have to know how much to trade. If you know how much to trade, you have to know the stochastic evolution of the underliers you're talking about, and nobody knows that accurately. So you're suddenly in a much more, not only a much less precise, less accurate world, but also a world that requires much more trading and software and systems. And if you can't do that, you're reduced to doing much cruder things, like saying these two things have the same risk, which is what you do with stocks, or looking at utility functions, and nobody really knows what the utility function is, unfortunately. And then for the same reason, I always like to argue, you really should avoid axiomatization, which has really taken over finance a lot in the last 20 years, 25 years since I started. I think it's a bad way to teach finance to start with. When I took physics, people used to try to teach, occasionally somebody would try to teach electromagnetic theory by writing down Maxwell's equations as a first class. And that's clever, but it gives you no intuition at all. It's much better for a second class. But at least it's true. But to start by teaching finance by writing down complicated stochastic calculus and utility functions and hedging and Gersonov's theorem, I always think is a very bad idea because A, it's not true, and B, it doesn't give you a lot of intuition. But somehow you see more and more people these days, well, if you say to somebody, I should stop, right? Okay. Okay, if you say to somebody, I used to interview people, if you say to somebody, why can you shoot a rocket to the moon, and they say, because I know Newton's laws, that's like a good answer. But you often find you say to people who come out of school, why can I price an option, and they ought to say, because I can replicate it approximately by something whose value I know, and instead they say to you, because of Gersonov's theorem, and they seem to have some delusion that Gersonov's theorem is on the same footing as Newton's laws, whereas it's really just some theoretical theorem anyway. That's my pet peeve. So I think it's a bad idea to teach this stuff by axiomatization unless you make it very clear that there are a bunch of axioms that aren't true. And then for some reason, I don't know why, there's no value judgment here, but somehow in physics it really does pay, or in the natural sciences, in chemistry, biology, to drop down deep and formulate a principle like the principle of least action or Newton's laws or Hamilton's principle. And write down something that looks really deep based on looking at the world, writing down something deep that you can't really figure out why it should be true, and then coming back up again and calculating the consequences, and miraculously it works. It's a mystery. In finance, I don't think anybody can write down the right behavior for a stochastic volatility model by writing down a stochastic equation for volatility. They're going to be wrong for sure. There isn't a hope in hell that they're going to be right. I'm not saying it's not interesting. And so I think if you really have to work with this stuff in practice, I think shallow is kind of better. And there are examples of models that try to go, instead of going down and then up again, try to go empirically in more of a straight line from what you know to what you need to know without, I'm not saying you shouldn't do both, but the top one's just as much, the shallow one's just as likely to be useful as the deep one, because the deep one's going to be wrong. There's something called the Vannevolga method, if anybody's interested, as an example of something that's shallow but kind of interesting. And so I was just going to say, since all models are bound to be wrong, I think it's your obligation, if you do this stuff, you have to sweep dirt under the rug, but you have to tell people that you're sweeping dirt under the rug and tell them what the dirt is. And I think Black-Scholes is actually, a lot of people curse Black-Scholes. I don't, because I think it's actually a very good model in the sense you can see exactly what it's assuming and you can see exactly what's being swept under the rug. If you study it, and so you can see what you're ignoring and make second order approximations, higher order approximations to say, I didn't quite take account of this, I didn't quite take account of that. What effect will it have? I'm going to try to finish off. Okay, so I was going to be cute and say, there's no theory of everything, you're lucky if there's a theory of anything in finance. And you're looking for trouble if you think that you can write down one equation that's going to describe the way people are behave. And so you've got to be a little cocky if you try to do financial modeling. And a little hubris is good, because if you don't shoot for something high, you're not going to get anywhere. But you have to look over your shoulder and make sure that your hubris doesn't evolve into idolatry, which I really think is some of the stuff is classic idolatry, to imagine that you can write down a human equation that describes the way markets, which are built out of people, are going to behave, is a kind of idolatry, and you're not going to get it right. It's like thinking you can explain the way people behave with an equation, and you have to, somewhere between these two extremes, south of idolatry but still being a little cocky, is the right way to do this. I'm going to stop there. Thanks.